From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Unitarian minister Tom Goldsmith likes to point out that the first Unitarian church in Utah began in 1891, the same year the sculpture of the angel Moroni went up on the Salt Lake Temple. The angel, Goldsmith says, looks steadfastly east. Now, compare that to the weather vane on the Unitarian church's steeple on 13th East. The reputation of Unitarians is that they move in whatever direction the wind blows, but Goldsmith sees it differently. He says that weather vane represents the role Unitarians have always played in Utah, meeting, as he puts it, conservative headwinds straight on, regardless of the direction they come. Unitarianism in Utah is 125 years old this year, so today in the program we're talking about its history and its place in the state. Also, the larger story of this movement, or church, or society, whatever you call it. Join us after the news.
Stay connected with KUER throughout the day on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll bring you stories from our local news team along with program updates and features from NPR, BBC, and other network providers. Get the scoop on upcoming events, meet your favorite public radio personalities, and find out what's happening at the station behind the scenes by following KUER on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Tom Goldsmith, senior minister at Utah's first Unitarian church, once said that Unitarian Universalists exist in Utah not only because they want to, but because they must. He said their calling was much more than just providing another Unitarian congregation along the American landscape. Unitarians in Utah, he said, have a responsibility to sustain liberal ideals which otherwise would be extinguished in this state. Which is not to say Unitarianism exists as a response to any conservative religious culture here or anywhere else, but providing an alternative way of thinking about ideas or religion is an important part of the history of this church or movement or society, whatever you want to call it, and it's been called all of those things over the years. The Unitarian Church in Utah is celebrating 125 years in Utah this year, which is giving us a chance to talk about its history, its ideas, and the role of progressive religion in American culture today. Joining us on the program is Tom Goldsmith, senior minister, as I said, at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. He's been with the congregation since 1987. Reverend, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Wonderful to be here, Doug. Thank you.
We also have with us on the program John Burens, senior minister at the First Unitarian Universalist Society of San Francisco. He's former president of Unitarian Universalist Association. He's written and co-authored a number of books on Unitarian Universalism. And Reverend Burens is joining us today from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. And Reverend Burens, welcome to you.
It's good to be with you, Doug, and with Tom.
I want to begin, Reverend Burens, with you. Right up front in one of the books you've written, you talk about – this seems to identify at least your sense of this religion or these ideas. And this is what you write. You say, religion is people. Explain what you mean.
Well, before it is a structure of doctrine or an organization or even a set of leaders – religion begins in the hearts of people. It begins with their awe and wonder before the existence of life itself. It begins with their sense of compassion for others. And that's cross-cultural. So I think religion has to go back to the deep heart of people if it's going to be authentic. It's when it gets all tied up in organizational matters and doctrinal matters that it becomes somewhat distorting.
Some people will say to you from time to time, I'm not religious. And you say your common response to that is, okay, fine, you're not religious. Then tell me about your experience. What
exactly
are you getting at there?
Well, I think that human beings have experiences that call to the heart and to the soul, if you will, that they're often looking for a place to share. And our communities don't ask them to fit their experience to that of any other person. We don't Emerson said, forego the good models. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to your own heart and soul. I was reminded of Emerson when Tom was speaking earlier about how we feel a calling to be where there is no authentic dialogue about religious matters. Emerson also said, go where freedom is not and say I am for it.
You, John, you say you still remember the first time you entered a Unitarian Universalist meeting house. This was, and this must have been an incredibly dramatic time. I mean, this was the spring of 1968.
Yes,
not, indeed. I guess not long after Dr. King had been killed.
Well, it was the night that he was killed.
Wow. And why did you go
there?
It
was sort of a spontaneous gathering in the Harvard Square meeting house. I was a senior at Harvard, and people were speaking about their sense of despair about our country, and I must say I felt it. But the meeting house had two wonderful inscriptions that I think were appropriate to a non-creedal approach to religious life. One was the simple quotation from the prophet Micah, "What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." And I had heard Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, of blessed memory, speak on that very text and warn young activists like myself that the prophets are often silenced because they ask questions that are unwelcome. And then he reminded us that there's no solution to be found in the lives of isolated human beings when the leadership of a prophetic movement like one for civil rights or for opposing the war in Vietnam are silenced. The only solution is to be found in the lives of communities that keep the important questions going. And I think that night I really felt a calling to be in a community that would ask the important questions, not pretend to have all the answers. Mm. And within a year I was in seminary.
You write that the failures of religion at that time were clear to you, and I wanted to mention some of these. You said religion fails when it suppresses individual questions and doubts. But here's another thing you say. You say it also fails when it becomes superficial, pleasingly aesthetic, or fashionably political. What do you mean by that? That the idea is we're just wearing this religion, not living it in some way?
Well, I grew up in the 1950s when, you know, there were churches that functioned as chapels to the country club, that were places where people went in order to sell insurance to their fellow congregants, where the attention was more on who was wearing what than on anything of any moral or spiritual depth. So I've seen phases in American religion when things were fairly superficial. And I was blessed by having a couple of parents with critical thinking who could see through those things and help me begin at quite an early age to see that that kind of superficiality needed to be challenged.
You also – but then the question is, okay, all right, so you're seeing superficiality in religion. So just ditch it. Live a secular life. But you've talked about the fact that for you anyway and for other people, that wasn't the counter. It wasn't the solution.
Yeah, well, I'm trained as a historian. And one of the more profound books about religion in American life speaks about this as a country with the soul of a church. Hmm. Practically every effort to make this a more whole society, to bring women into fuller participation, to overcome the legacy of slavery and racial oppression, to deal with misuses of our power in relation to other countries abroad. All of these movements have been combinations of secular activists and progressive religious activists. If we're going to be a whole country, we desperately need the voice of a self-critical and progressive religious force. It was important in the founding of our country. Mm-hmm. Many of the founders, Adams, Jefferson, were Unitarians. If we lose that strand of progressive self-critical religion in America, if we turn religion over only to its most conservative voices, I think the soul of the country is in great danger.
Tom Goldsmith, I'm not sure whether you, like John Burens can pinpoint the time you first wandered into a meeting house. Can you? And can you remember the first inkling of these ideas when you started thinking about them?
I'm kind of at a disadvantage here because I was actually raised a Unitarian Universalist. I'm jealous of John, who had that wonderful aha experience walking into that meeting house in Cambridge. So I just was nurtured by it and never thought in a million years I'd be a Unitarian Universalist minister. But I never had that moment.
Do you remember when it first started to mean something to you? I mean, this was sort of the way you lived, I suppose, but when you started to be really clear about how the ideas worked in the world and your response to them?
It became really clear to me probably not until I went to theological school and was working together with people of who were training for the clergy in other denominations. And it was just the sharing of ideas and perspectives that really helped me solidify the need for a religious and moral expression that really upholds a more progressive point of view. And I mean, my colleagues were indeed good friends, but it just really underscored the almost the urgency to be able to articulate certain religious values that I think would help sustain society in a good way.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the history of these ideas. John Burens, you mentioned how these movements were kind of American, that in many ways a lot of these ideas were not just imported from someplace else. Would you talk a little bit about how universalism, Unitarianism, was connected really to these ideas of American independence? Was there a sense of kind of response to or defiance embedded in these ideas?
Well, both sides of our religious family really emerge at the time of the American Revolution. The Unitarian side can best be characterized as Reform theology, the theology that was held by the New England Puritans, meeting the Enlightenment with all of that meant, with a greater emphasis on human reason, but with the application of God-given reason to the interpretation of the scriptural heritage. The Universalists were not so much up in their heads as they were people of the heart. They could not square the idea of a loving God with the idea of being threatened with eternal punishment in hell. And they believed that if Jesus had announced anything at all, he had announced God's intention for the universal salvation of all souls. For almost a century and a half, the two liberal religious denominations operated in parallel.
Yeah.
They were often cooperative with one another and even exchanged ministers. I now preach from the pulpit occupied once by the great Thomas Starr King, who helped keep California in the Union during the Civil War. Starr King had been raised by a Universalist family, but then became the minister of a Unitarian church in Boston before he came out here to San Francisco. He famously said once that the difference between the two denominations was that the Unitarians were always involved in do-gooding and thought that they were too good to be damned, whereas the Universalists believed that God was simply too good to damn them. And there's a certain amount of truth of that distinction. The Universalists were, for the most part, like Starr King, not college educated. Mm. Their clergy were people who had studied the scriptures on their own and had been mentored. I should say to Tom that it was people like him who had been raised in Unitarian Universalist homes who were among my most respected friends at college, without whom I would not have gone into that meeting house. Hmm. It was people who were raised in Unitarian Universalist homes who showed me what it was to be a person of principle, to be involved in the complex moral issues of the time without being crazy or radical. Sometimes radical, yes, but not crazy about it.
Yeah.
And that was a real difference in a time like 1968, 1969 when I began seminary. We've always applied ourselves to the very difficult issues with a kind of persistence that I think is really one of our chief characteristics that often gets lost. The idea that we swing with the wind like the weather vane is really not at all the case. I remember after serving as president of the denomination being faced with the question, where would I put my moral energies? And I was offered an opportunity to go on the steering committee of the first central organization to work on marriage equality, freedom to marry. I knew that had my name on it. During my time as president, we'd been the first denomination to say that we would not only bless the unions of same-sex couples, but we would advocate for their full legal recognition. And when I went into that meeting, I was the only non-gay person in the room, much less the only religious leader. And I said to them, I think I'm here to point out to you that you have more allies than you know. Not just Unitarian Universalists, but progressive people of many stripes of faith, and I intend to put you in touch with them. I think that that's one reason we were able to change American public opinion so much on that vital civil rights question. It was very much in line with our central value of the worth and dignity of every human person.
Let me just add to that that the history, many people are just really astonished when they find out that the history of Unitarianism goes back to the 16th century, actually in Transylvania, and the foundation. So much of what John was speaking about can actually be traced to the origins of Unitarianism, which arose during the Protestant Reformation. And that was a time when Calvinists and Lutherans and Catholics were, I mean, they were threatening each other's lives because of their beliefs. In Transylvania, which is now kind of the area of Romania and Hungary and some of the Czech Republic, we actually had our one and only king. And this king...
You had a Unitarian king?
Yeah, we had a Unitarian king. And what was so remarkable about King John Sigismund is that he came in about 1560, had a Unitarian court preacher, and worked with Francis David, his court preacher, on crafting what was called the Edict of Tolerance. That was about 1567. Wow. It's a legitimate document. Anybody can Google it. It's just fascinating. And it really called for greater tolerance, mercy, cooperation, compassion. And it is...
Is that remarkable for the context of the time?
I think it's astounding. Yeah. Absolutely. But it was absolutely pivotal as kind of a launching point where we can now, where we Unitarian Universalists can speak of the compassion and wider tolerance that we have for those people who've been forced to the margins of society.
I want to get back to this idea, something that John Behrens was responding to, and I know, Reverend Goldsmith, you've talked about this also, this kind of caricature of Unitarianism, that it's like that weather vane mm-hmm. on your church on 13th East, that it just swings whichever direction the wind blows. It's whatever. It's all relativism. You know, I want to get to that when we get back from a break. Mm-hmm. Tom Goldsmith is with us, senior minister at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. John Behrens, senior minister at the First Unitarian Universalist Society of San Francisco. He's the co-author of a number of books, among them A Chosen Faith, An Introduction to Unitarian Universalism. And we'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about Unitarians, Unitarian Universalists, and what it is they believe exactly. Way back in the late 1800s, Utah's Unitarian congregation was just getting started, and the Reverend Stanley Hunter proclaimed that there was this need for a liberal religion in this state. Well, the first Unitarian church in Utah has been around for 125 years now, and it's giving us an opportunity to talk about the history of it here in Utah, but also more broadly. We have with us Tom Goldsmith, senior minister at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City, and John Burens is with us, senior minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Society of San Francisco. Okay, so we have a question that has come from Jim, and I think it's a question that a lot of people get. And he writes this, I've wondered where Jesus Christ or even God fits into the Unitarian Universalist cosmology and belief. All right, let's back up just a little bit, and I want to have you address, John Burens, the stereotype of Unitarianism, Universalism, is that it's just like that weather vane, that it just sort of whatever goes, it doesn't really matter. There are no moral absolutes. It's just sort of whatever is acceptable. How do you respond to that general notion first?
Well, it certainly is a caricature. It's simply not true. Liberals are, of course, open to what is happening in the wider culture. That doesn't mean that our inner lives, particularly morally or spiritually, are simply responses to what's happening in the wider culture. And I think we've demonstrated that all the way through our history, from the time of the American Revolution, through the women's suffrage movement and the abolitionist movement, and among the first people to promote the serious study and application of evolution to religious life, and now down to our advocacy for full equality for our GLBT brothers and sisters. I think that our principles are a good way of summarizing some of the deep values that have always guided us. We do speak about the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. We speak about regarding ourselves as simply a part of an interdependent network of all existence, so that our stewardship of the environment is a powerful force. I mean, Henry David Thoreau, somewhat alienated Unitarian of his time, said, "In wildness is the preservation of the world," a motto that John Muir picked up as the motto of the Sierra Club. Our sense of the natural world has always been a guiding principle for us as well. So, no, the cultural winds are admitted to our meeting houses, but they don't guide them.
It's so interesting. I'm wondering where you are in terms of have you settled into some kind of sense of the nature of God, some sort of theology? It's interesting. In one of your books, John Burens, you write about the Universalist Convention of 1803. This was in New Hampshire, and they adopted this profession of faith. Among them, Article 1, "We believe that the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament contain a revelation of the character of God and of the duty, interest, and final destination of mankind." And then it goes on in these other articles to say that we believe there's one God whose nature is love. We believe that holiness and true happiness are in. So there is a sort of a clear theology here. There's a God. There's one God. There's a sense of a kind of a plan of salvation in all of this. Now, I guess the question is, and this seems like something that Jim seems to be wondering about, where are Unitarian Universalists on the nature of God today? Do you believe that there is one God? Do you even still believe in an actual God? How do you respond to those questions?
Well, the Universalist side of the family was more confessional.
Yeah.
They persisted in having affirmations of faith. The Unitarian side of the family was more convinced that covenant was the approach to forming religious community, not creed. In that sense, they were going back to the early settlers of New England who came here in covenant with one another and with their God to try to be a city on the hill, to try to be a moral example in the world. Ronald Reagan lifted up that aspiration on the part of the early Puritans and the early English settlers in America. The Unitarians, after the American Revolution, split with the Congregationalists who wanted to hang on to the creeds and said, no, we're going to put the creeds aside. We're not going to require people to stand in church and make a confession of faith. We're going to have the kind of open church from which, said William Ellery Channing, no one can be excommunicated except by the death of goodness in their own breast. So our congregations today operate more on the Unitarian model than the Universalist model. They operate on the basis of covenantal relations, where we come together not to ask, what do you believe? Do you believe exactly as I do? Mm-hmm. But are you willing to walk in covenant with me towards some shared hopes? And how are we going to promise to treat one another as we move toward those hopes? I believe that actually this is a good prescription for interfaith relations as well. It's what allows in our congregation someone whose personal spirituality is grounded deeply in Buddhist meditation to be sitting in the pew next to someone who treasures their Jewish heritage and lights candles on Friday evening, next to somebody who may have had communion at the Catholic Mass before coming to the Unitarian service.
Yeah.
I've seen all of those people in my worship services.
Hey, Doug, I just want to answer Jim's question a little more directly, because it's a question that we face all the time. And I think what is helpful to understand the role of Jesus and God is to first understand just the word Unitarian, which really stands in contrast with Trinitarian. So rather than, again, it goes back to the 1500s, rather than a belief of God in three parts, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the Unitarians back in the 16th century proclaimed the unity of one God. An interesting thing happens when you make that kind of proclamation, that as well, if there's unity of one God, then who is Jesus? Where does Jesus fit into
right.
all of this?
Right.
And so what happens is Jesus then becomes a historical being. We definitely believe in the historical Jesus, but does not sit at the right hand of God. So instead, Jesus becomes like one of the prophets of all the world's great religions, becomes an exemplar of how we ought to live our lives, and an inspiration for some of the really big questions that we face: who is our neighbor, love our enemies. Wonderful messages that can help us today.
One of our listeners sent in a joke, and you may or may not be offended by this, but Jack Gallivan, a prominent Utah mm-hmm. Catholic, used to joke that the only time the words Jesus Christ were used in the Unitarian Church was when the janitor fell down the stairs. How do you respond to that joke?
Well, I tell you, John and I have heard that a lot of times.
I was going to say, I'm guessing you've heard that joke a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny take on.
Is it offensive?
No, not at all. It merely points out that the Unitarian Universalist tradition is one that does not exalt Jesus, and it's we don't believe in Jesus leading us to life everlasting, and so Jesus just, you know,
in a sense,
is modified as a prophet, teaching us how to live,
okay.
but is not a deity.
Right, okay. That's kind of the right. crucial point. And John Bierens, in your book, which you co-wrote with Forrest Church, he talks about this kind of moment of revelation for him when he first encountered Thomas Jefferson's sort of reworking of the New Testament, where
right.
Jefferson essentially excises out, literally with the scissors, all of the parts of the supernatural divinity references to Jesus Christ. He kept in, of course, all the moral teachings, all the parables, all those kinds of things. But the idea of a resurrection, the idea of the divinity of Jesus Christ, he took that out. And I suppose in some way for Forrest Church, that was sort of freeing. You want to talk about that part?
Well, you know, I wish Forrest were here to speak for himself. Unfortunately, my dear friend died a few years back.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things that for young Forrest was important there was to find a religion that was compatible with the results of science, that was compatible with what we experience as reality. A religion based on miracle has a problem right at the start. As Emerson put it, there's but one miracle, the fact that we are alive, the fact that there is something rather than nothing. I mean, that alone, life should awe us. We don't need to see demonstrations of, you know, walking on water, although I would be the first to say that Jefferson may have been too much of a literalist and not to have recognized that, for example, in that story, those who were remembering Jesus after his death remembered him as somebody who had moved through one of the stormiest times in Jewish history, the time of Roman oppression that was coming close to the destruction of the temple. And he had moved through it with a calm, with a persistence, with a moral compass that was so memorable that they had to symbolize it as walking literally across the storm-tossed waters of the Sea of Galilee. So we aren't stuck back with Jefferson in being too terribly literal about these things either. Mm. Our faith unfolds in a whole variety of ways that engage both the heart and the head.
What are you supposed to do with the sinner, Tom Goldsmith? I mean, there was this idea, there have been disputes, I know, throughout time, between Unitarians probably too. What are we supposed to do with the sinner? Are they damned later? Are they just punished here? Will they be dealt with later? Of course, there will be universal forgiveness. Mm-hmm. God will welcome them into his, you know, into his bosom. But this is one thing that conventional Christians or conventional religious people probably are confused about in terms of the Unitarian viewpoint. What do you do with the idea of moral sin?
Well, the how you identify the sinners, of course, is perhaps the at the very nub of the question. Yes. You know, many in the more traditional and dogmatic faiths will view homosexuality as a sin, and so they struggle with, you know, their pet answer of, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin.
Yeah.
Well, for us, people who are in same-sex relations are not sinners. People who find themselves imprisoned by poverty are not sinners. We have a much wider inclusivity of people. Our compassion extends to those who.
But what's
give me an example
so,
of
so
a
do
sin?
Do you believe there is sin?
Well, I think
let me leap in here because I preached about this just this past Sunday.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Entitled "The Awareness of Evil."
Right.
Indeed, I don't think that there's any question, but that we're very aware of the evils that go on in the world. They are often quite systemic and anonymous. And you know, the revelations of the offshore companies and tax dodging of many of the world's elite that came out last week in the Panama Papers was one of my examples on Sunday. Hmm. So, you know, what do you do with the sinners of that sort? Well, Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian novelist in the Gulag Archipelago, said it would be so good if there were just good people like me and bad people out there. But the truth is that the line between good and evil runs down through the middle of every human heart. I think at our best, we humbly recognize that we are constantly wrestling with temptations for lesser goods, that we are not pure, that we have to extend forgiveness on the principle that Jesus suggested in that great story about casting the first stone. None of us are all that pure, and therefore we have to be in community with one another to heighten our awareness of moral choice and to deal constructively rather than destructively with the failures of our fellow humans. That's why we're committed to things like restorative justice rather than punitive justice, why we want to see reform in our criminal justice system that does away with things like the death penalty, which most civilized societies have put aside. So we're very aware of both sin, death, and evil, unlike some more metaphysical forms of religion. But we try to deal with them in a this-worldly, constructive fashion.
John Buren's is with us. John Buren's, stay with us. He's a senior minister at the First Unitarian Universalist Society of San Francisco. When we get back from a break, we're going to talk to Tom Goldsmith about the history of Unitarianism in Utah. You say there are a lot of good stories?
Oh, millions.
Yeah, but you've got a lot.
Let's extend the show.
Senior minister for the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City, Tom Goldsmith, is with us. And we'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The First Unitarian Church in Utah has been around 125 years now, which is giving us an opportunity to talk about their history and their ideas. Tom Goldsmith is with us, John Buren's as well. Tom Goldsmith is senior minister with the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. And this is one of the great stories. A Unitarian is the one who first constructed the sculpted the Angel Moroni that ended up on the Salt Lake Temple?
Absolutely. That was 1891. Cyrus Dallin is originally from Utah. He was a sculptor, but wanted to perfect his art, and he went to Boston. And it was in Boston that not only did he perfect his fine technique in sculpturing, but he explored different religions, and wound up at the Unitarian Church in Roxbury. And there he met a wonderful woman, the love of his life, Victoria Murray, and he became a Unitarian. He was well known in Boston because there was a contest for some kind of a sculpture of Paul Revere to be placed in front of the Old North Church. And so this very famous, it was iconic sculpture of Paul Revere on a horseback, that was Cyrus Dallin. Cyrus loved Utah, came back to Salt Lake City with his wife, and she, as a Boston Brahmin, was not particularly happy to be here. But he thought he was famous now, that he can get commissioned to do anything, but there was no job for him because most of the commissions were actually handed out by the LDS Church. President Woodruff was president of the LDS Church at that time. And to make a long story short, after Cyrus Dallin gave a personal gift to President Woodruff, Woodruff said, well, maybe there is one commission we can have you do, and that is we need to have the Angel Moroni on top of the temple spire. And so he accepted that offer. And the irony or the punchline of the whole story is that his wife, Victoria Murray, was actually the model as he was working on the sculpture of, of the Angel Moroni. Yeah.
Put 1891 in context, because this also happens to be the first year. This is the year that the Unitarianism became a sort of official organization. In
exactly
state.
Right. Yeah. And
it wasn't a state yet, but soon to be a state. Anyway,
it was 5 years before Utah became a state. And it's a wonderful beginning. Samuel Atkins Elliott was the Unitarian minister in Denver. And he had some friends from back in his Harvard days, and people that some students that he sang in the Harvard Glee Club with, who had settled in Salt Lake City. And Samuel Atkins Elliott was quite a prominent speaker, and his friends in Salt Lake begged for him to come and kind of get some, plant some seeds for a Unitarian church in Salt Lake. And finally, he did come, and it was in December of 1890. He gave two talks about Unitarianism. Before he came, he said to his friends rather skeptically, "Good heavens, how many people do you think will show up in Salt Lake City to hear me?"
Yeah.
And they said, "Well, we are really, and we're going to just, you know, hand out pamphlets to every human body walking by Main Street." I mean, and he said, "Well, what's the bottom line?" He said, "Well, 50. We'll guarantee you 50 people."
Right.
And it turned out that the topic of a non-dogmatic religion, freedom of belief, was so exciting that 300 people came to hear Eliot. That was December of 1890, and he was so convincing and powerful that 2 months later, in February 1891, 127 people were charter members of the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake.
There's a story you tell. This David Utter is his name.
Yes, yes.
He
was the first called minister.
The first called minister, right. And you say as soon as the church was established, it really started rocking the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about Utter is he has this idea about biblical criticism, right. Which you've put it this way. You've said it was pretty mind blowing for the time.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about David Utter and his role in this history of everything?
Oh, sure. I mean, he was quite intellectual. He was also Harvard trained, and the whole idea of biblical criticism actually was still relatively new to the whole country. The birthplace was amongst some theologians in Germany. It was about the 1860s, maybe early 1870s, and of course, it took a little time to cross the pond. And David Utter was absolutely fascinated by the whole idea of biblical criticism, to look at the hermeneutics, take to some exegetical studies of Scripture, and to be able to stand on solid ground and critique the Bible, that it is, you know, not the Word of God. It is not to be taken literally. But when you put it into the context of what was happening historically, when you look at it in terms of how was it translated, why were certain words used for the translation, then the whole new picture emerges of Scripture. Mm-hmm. And he took this new, exciting field with him to Salt Lake City, and I mean, this was just as part of his bag of tricks, so to speak. I mean, this was, I mean, he was just armed with wonderful new ideas of how to approach religion, how to approach theology, views on Scripture, and it was hot stuff in 1891 in Salt Lake City.
So I guess there's a question that comes up, and I mentioned this actually earlier in the introduction. This is what you said, that it feels to me we exist here not only because we want to, but because we must, that we have this higher calling to sustain liberal ideals that in some cases you say would have been extinguished if there wasn't this powerful, at least organized anyway. I'm not sure whether how powerful you are, but how organized group of people to respond. And you mentioned the relationship with Planned Parenthood and the National Organization for Women and the first Saturday's Voyeur.
That's right.
For the Salt Lake Acting Company was at the Unitarian Church. So obviously this idea of dissent and parody and response to the predominant religious culture, Mormonism here. How does it work? How do you talk about your relationship with Mormon orthodoxy and is it something that fuels you? I wouldn't say say it defines you, but it certainly seems to give you an extra sort of impetus maybe to your work?
Yeah, well, not only for the Unitarian Universalists, but I think even mainline Protestantism, because of the predominant religion, I think has moved every denomination just slightly or maybe more than slightly to the left. Mm-hmm. I think the Episcopal diocese here is a very progressive, just a wonderful institution, and to a large degree the Catholic diocese as well. Paul's been pushed a little bit to the left in order to define themselves over and against the predominant religion. Working relationship with the LDS Church has really been pretty good. We've had some cooperative efforts that I think have helped Salt Lake City enormously. We have worked with some LDS wards on the west side of town, and some of the schools that are in challenged neighborhoods. We've certainly worked together with them, but you know, it's also important to present to the people of Salt Lake City an option or an alternative to what is really a very conservative religious mindset. And what we offer is, and it couldn't really be more basic or fundamental. And we can go back thousands of years to Socrates, who said that the unexamined life is not worth living. Yeah. And we're giving people the opportunity to say, you know, religion is not all about conformity of belief. If you have questions and you are examining some very important issues theologically, big issues of why am I here, what's my purpose, what's the meaning of life, you have an alternative to just going to probably the religion of your childhood and have a chance to examine this a little more critically. And by offering this alternative, I think the Unitarian Church has just grown immensely.
One of the things John Buehrens was mentioning earlier was the relationship between Unitarian Universalism and nature. And this has been a really important thing, I think, for the First Unitarian Church in Utah, eco-justice, as you've called it. And you often talk, Reverend Goldsmith, about the place of, placing the origins of the church in the context of a landscape, the idea of nature being sacred. And reimagining, as you've put it, the West, that's become part of your spiritual mission. Would you talk about the importance of land, of the environment in sure. the way you see the world?
The natural landscape is a very powerful spiritual force. It is where so many progressive people, not only the transcendentalists of the 19th century, but today, we can just speak about the splendor of Utah, where we really get a sense of awe and wonder and splendor and beauty. It feeds the soul. What is absolutely imperative is taking care of this land. Throughout, Unitarian Universalism has been really less concerned about the creator because we're never going to get a definitive answer. So rather than focus so much on the creator, we are really focused on the creation. What is our responsibility for the care of this earth? How do we help the sustainability of the earth? We do this because it is, first of all, primary, a responsibility of ours, and also because it feeds us spiritually.
John Buehrens, I want to come back to you finally today. You've co-written a book called A House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century. Let me read a comment that came from Tara, who's in Moab, Utah. She said, I was raised Unitarian in Dallas. The minister once told my father the Unitarian Church was just a stepping stone on your way to atheism. Now, I'm not sure if that's a joke, but I don't want to get you to respond to that in the context of something you write right in the introduction of your book. You say that America's liberals and progressives need greater awareness that at the core of social and political issues lie competing responses to the classic questions posed by theology. And you say effective work for social change will require people of faith who are theologically literate and engaged. In other words, not on their way to atheism, but engaged in a kind of theology. Would you talk about that? Because you seem to be hopeful, but you also say that there seem to be some conditions for all of that.
Well, let me say first that even atheology, that is the denial of the ordinary concepts of God, can be a form of doing theological reflection. One of my most important instructors at Harvard Divinity School took that, Mark C. Taylor took that stand. So I don't dismiss people who are critical of conventional notions of divinity. What I help them try to do, however, is to see that saying no to a failed idea is not as important as beginning to say yes to those ideas that can really guide our constructive community building in relationship to the creation, as Thomas pointed out. So theological reflection is both a critical and a constructive enterprise. And I try to help people, both in the books that I've written and in the ministry that I conduct in local congregations and as the national leader, do both. Do critical thinking and then do affirmative spiritual work. That's what that book, A House for Hope, is all about. I did it with Rebecca Parker, who is the president of our seminary out here in Berkeley and is also a United Methodist minister, by the way. All of my work has been trying to go across some of the usual and simplistic divisions in order to help people do constructive religious work together.
Tom Goldsmith, let me give you the final word. To that point, the idea, as John Behrens talks about, that social change is going to require people who are theologically literate, spiritually literate, and engaged. Are you with him on that?
I concur totally. Yes, it's not a matter of simply kicking back. People like to do shorthand and say, "Oh, Unitarians can believe anything they want." That is so far from the actual situation. We are engaged in spiritual work, spiritual practice. We are engaged with theological reflection. It's not a matter of just moving as the wind blows.
Tom Goldsmith, senior minister at the First Unitarian Church of Salt Lake City. Happy 125th.
Thank you very much, Doug.
Congratulations. Thanks for being with us. John Behrens, senior minister of First Unitarian Universalist Society of San Francisco, his most recent book we mentioned, co-authored with Rebecca Ann Parker, is A House for Hope, The Promise of Progressive Religion for the 21st Century. Joined us from a studio in San Francisco. John Behrens, thanks to you.
Great honor. You're a great interviewer, Doug.
Thanks very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.